Good evening, this is Paul Fromm, and here you are on the fighting side of me on Counter Currents Radio. Lots of news and views for our people, and just in case anybody's a little hazy about that, our people are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, and of course, all of you who might be listening in the European heartland. Just a little bit of an introduction. Again, this is my second broadcast. I was with Reason Radio for about 2 years, and Reason Radio's been going through a bit of a bad patch, being off the air now for a number of weeks, and Countercurrents is picking up the slack, stay tuned for further announcements, which you'll be able to catch me here, not at a regular time, but actually as soon as the broadcast is posted. That way, you know, you might want to keep checking back, and if you like what you hear, good way to keep current, and you won't have to wait around for a particular time of the week or whatever. The broadcast will be posted pretty much when they're done. Some rather interesting things I'd like to share with you tonight. One of them has to do with an interview that I wanted to conduct, but was not able to, with a good friend of mine named Brad Love. You know, can you imagine somebody going to jail solely for the non-violent expression of their political views in letters written mostly to politicians? You know, you say, no, come on, that must have been in North Korea. You're not talking about, yes, I am talking about Canada. I'm going to tell you the Brad Love story. But before I do that, I'd like to pick up on something that we seem to hear a great deal about. And that is the absolutely unstoppable argument, unstoppable desire of certain people to promote mass immigration. And the reason they argue this is, they say, is economic. There's one particular person I've been marveling at for a number of years, and his name is John Ibbotson. He's a columnist for the Globe and Mail. And a few years ago, he wrote something that, you know, if it had been said in the reverse, would probably have got him fired. He proclaimed that the problem with Canada's maritime provinces, those are Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland, is that they're too white. He said that. They're too white. Can you imagine by saying, for instance, that the problem with Vancouver is there are too many Chinese, or the problem with certain ghetto areas of Toronto, let's say the Jane Finch quarters, are too many blacks. Well, I mean, unless that was very carefully qualified, yeah, there'd be hell to pay. This is what he said. The problem was that the Maritime Sisters are too white. And he as much as said they're just old, they're old fogies, they're tied to unemployment insurance, they're not that hard working. And what they need is an influx of immigration. And most of it, of course, the immigration patterns in Canada, I mean, mostly from the third world. We need more immigration, he felt, and they'll come from the third world. These people will come and they'll work their little brown rear ends off, and they'll bring the entrepreneurial spirit, and the hard work will pay taxes, and there'll be all sorts of great advantages and so on. I thought, you know, quite apart from the incredible boldness of this statement, but look at the rudeness. The automatic assumption that everybody in the Maritimes is basically a retard, is lazy, has no get up and go, no entrepreneurial skills, which is absolutely not the case. There are some amazing industries in the Maritimes. Two very, very wealthy families, the McCains, who are well known for their fast foods, particularly potato chips French fries, frozen French fries for cooking. They're literally billionaires. The Irving Company, that is into a whole host of things, including shipping, gasoline, oil refining, et cetera, et cetera. So the notion that the Maritimers are just dunderheads, that need immigration is dead wrong. But the more fundamental, challenge to that glib little, assertion is, okay, fine, an immigrant comes to the Maritimes, and what does that person do? Come on, there's high unemployment in the Maritimes. Isn't this a bit of a warning? For one thing, a wise immigrant probably wouldn't come. Well, why? Well, what's he going to do? There's high unemployment. What is he going to do? But, okay, let's assume the immigrant arrives in the Maritimes, and there are one of two and only one of two possibilities. One, he gets a job. Now, what's the economic effect of that? Well, the economic effect of that is a Maritimer does not get the job. In fact, this newcomer takes the job that ought to go to a local person. Result? Well, that local person, if he already has a job, goes on unemployment insurance, burden to the Canadian taxpayer. Or, if he has no job already, that person remains unemployed, and therefore on the public purse, or it has to go on welfare, and again, on the public purse. That's one possibility. No benefit to the Maritimes, in fact, just the opposite. The other possibility is that the immigrant newcomer does not get a job. Result? Well, we have to support him. So he goes on welfare, and because he's poor and he's new, he probably has to go into subsidized housing. Who pays? We do. Now, where's the benefit of immigration? The only possible time that notion that immigration would benefit us, the only time that might be true is if we had full employment. If there really are jobs there that we don't have people to do. At that point, yes. Anyway, Mr. Ibbotson on this topic is a one-note nilly. There's currently an election going on in the province of Quebec. It's a provincial election, and there are a number of parties vying for power, and that's not really the point of my commentary, but Mr. Ibbotson wrote an opinion piece back on August the 20th, and he said, Quebec committing slow-motion suicide. In order to preserve its culture, province is driving away new wealth and talent, so says Mr. Ibbotson. And he's basing his comments on comments made by Pauline Marois, who is the leader of the separatist Bloc Québécois. Now, you have to have a bit of background about the Bloc Québécois. They are nationalists, but they're socialists. No, they're not national socialists. No. It's a very left-wing party. And their nationalism is a kind of a weird duck. It has very little to do with ethnic nationalism. They don't define the French fact in Quebec as being racially French, or the descendants of les habitants, the settlers of Quebec, the French settlers of Quebec who came in the 17th and 18th centuries. No. They define a Quebecer or a Québécois as anybody who speaks French. Hence, of course, you get the weird problem people from Vietnam, people from Morocco, Algeria, the Congo, Haiti, God help us, streaming into Quebec. Well, they're not Québécois. For most of them, maybe not all, but for most of them, their culture is no way French or European. But the Bloc Québécois has this very unusual approach to nationality and culture. It wasn't always so. There was what you might call a traditionalist, or to use a term I don't find very helpful, right-wing faction in the early days that insisted on the European French fact. Nonetheless, identity is a big question in Quebec, and So the leader of the Parks and Quebecois has tried to do a bit of dancing around to still address the concerns of people who, many of the many Quebecers, who are worried about their national identity being threatened by exactly what's threatening it in English Canada. Immigrants from radically different cultures, who of course are encouraged to keep their ethnic differences, their cultural differences, by our doctrine of multiculturalism. This doctrine says, of course, that all cultures are equal. No culture is any better than any other one. In fact, your culture is probably a little bit better than mine, and you ought to, in fact, you should be encouraged, maybe even subsidized, to keep your culture, no matter how weird it is, or maybe how unacceptable it is here. Well, more and more, that idiotic but dangerous concept has come under attack, and it's also come under attack in the province of Quebec. Anyway, Mr. Ibbotson picks up his theme. He says, the Parti Québécois leader, that's Mrs. Marois, her proposal for a law to ban the wearing of conspicuous religious symbols, such as turbans, skull caps, or other head coverings by provincial employees, while permitting a discreet crucifix on a necklace, will only make the problem worse. Now, what's that problem? The province, according to Mr. Ibbotson, is committing slow-motion demographic suicide. Year after year, it fails to bring in enough newcomers to replenish the diminishing ranks of the native born. Now, this has to be seen in a bit of a reality check. The native born are not dying out in the province of Quebec. Their numbers are not expanding because of a relatively low birth rate. He says year after year, that's the immigration policies in the province of Quebec fail to bring in enough newcomers to replenish the diminishing ranks. Well, what if they weren't replenished? What will be the result? One of the results might be more job opportunities. Quebec, too, suffers from high unemployment. You bring more people in, you have high unemployment, with lower employment opportunities for those who are already there because of the incoming competition. How does that benefit them? It's not just a matter of numbers. Mr. Ibbotson takes the view that eventually, with a low birth rate, the numbers of Quebecois or French Canadians will decline. That might be true. But, and here's a but, there will be a moment when there's close to full employment. When there's close to full employment, a lot of the young people who then now have a decent job will say, time to form a family. This is natural. It's also the people in Quebec are somehow unnatural and don't want to have children. They do. But what holds them back, as holds back people right across North America and in English Canada, is the insecurity of employment. Either high unemployment rates or iffy job prospects, or having to try to get by with two or three mick jobs instead of a decent living wage sort of job. So he goes on to argue that proposals that would make immigrants, at least if they are provincial employees, not where cultural proclamations like turbans or skull caps or hijabs or burqas. He says, well, this is unwelcoming. It may drive immigrants away. So what? Absolutely, so what? He goes on to argue, demographic decline is the greatest problem afflicting Quebec society. Not enough babies are being born to sustain the population, he says. The average age in Quebec is older than in any other province to the west. Without young, skilled immigrants to fill vacant jobs, pay taxes that sustain social programs, and contribute to pension funds for older folks, those jobs, programs, and pensions will eventually disappear. The only word in there that has the slightest grain of truth in it is eventually. So he says, There's a demographic decline in Quebec. It's the greatest problem facing Quebec. It's not the greatest problem facing Quebec. There are a number of problems facing Quebec. Well, one of them is high unemployment. How is bringing in immigration at this time going to do anything about unemployment? Well, it's not. It's absolutely not. He says we need these young immigrants, young skilled immigrants. Well, most of the people coming are not skilled. They don't have job skills. They often don't have even proper language skills. To fill the vacant jobs. What vacant jobs, Mr. Ibbotson? What vacant jobs? With a higher than an average unemployment rate. Canada's wide unemployment rate, 7.3%. With higher unemployment than that, what vacant jobs? This is a widespread establishment argument. We need immigration to fill vacant jobs. What vacant jobs with high unemployment rates? And then all these other things they're going to wear. They'll work hard. They'll pay taxes to pay for the social programs and the pensions. Well, actually, we pay for our own pensions. The pension deductions taken from people's paycheck and matched by the employer. He then goes on to say that the Quebec's French language requirements ensure that many of the immigrants who do arrive in that province come from poor parts of the globe, where new arrivals are less likely to have the education and skills needed to contribute. In 2010, for example, 50% of immigrants to Ontario came from Asia or the Pacific, with the emerging economic powerhouses of China and India being two of the biggest sources of source countries, but not many of them speak or want to learn French. The immigration to Quebec because of the language requirement, according to Mr. Ibbotson, is coming in large measure from Africa and the Middle East and from Haiti, where people, even he admits, have low skills. So how would be bringing in people like that help Quebec? Well, it won't. If they have very few skills, they will probably be poor and not contribute, and probably will be a drain on the economy. Or, if they do manage to snag a job, it will make a Quebecer unemployed. Net result, disaster. Immigration is not the solution to Quebec's demographic or economic problems. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. I'm going to be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Going to have a short musical interlude here, and then I'm going to talk to you about my friend Brad Love and a story that you may not believe. I hope you do believe it, though, because it's one I've been covering for 9 years. He's a man who has been jailed twice now for nothing more than the nonviolent expression of his political opinions, in fact, for writing letters. Well, a little tip of the hat to a place of the part of the United States I really like. It's, of course, the States of the Old Confederacy, and this is a song called The Bonnie Blue Flag. Hope you liked it. Paul Fromm back with you in just a couple of minutes.
Our band of brothers and native to the soul, fighting for the property we gained by honest toll. When our rights were threatened, the cry rose near and far. Hurrah for the bonnie blue flag, get back the single star. Hurrah, hurrah, for southern rights, hurrah. Hurrah for the bonnie blue flag, get back the single star. As long as the Union was faithful to your trust, like friends and like brothers both, kind were we and just. But now in northern treachery attempts our rights to mar, we boys don't have a bonnie blue flag that bears a single star. First gallant South Carolina nobly made the stand, then gave Alabama to provide our hand, and quickly Mississippi, Georgia, Florida, all raised on high the bonnie blue flag that bears the single star. Hurrah, hurrah, southern rights, hurrah. Hurrah for the bonny blue flag that bears a single star. And men of valor gather round the banner of the right. Texas and Louisiana joined us in the fight. David, our loved president, and Stephen, statesmen are. Now rally round the bonny blue flag that bears a single star. And here's to old Virginia, the old Dominion state. Who with the young Confederacy had limped at length her fate, and held by her example, now other states prepare to hoist on high the bonny blue flag that bears a single star. Hurrah, hurrah, for Southern rights, hurrah, hurrah for the bonny blue flag that bears a single star. And cheer, boys, cheer, raise up the joyous shout. For Arkansas and North Carolina now have both gone out. And let another rousing cheer for Tennessee be given. The single star, the bonny blue flag, has grown to be 11. Hurrah, hurrah, for Southern rights, hurrah. Hurrah for the bonny blue flag that bears the single star.
The bonny blue flag. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here. On Counter Currents Radio, where this is kind of a successor to Reason Radio. Been some problems with Reason Radio, and a group of people centered around Counter Currents have pulled together now the original broadcasters, and so you have what you see now. Counter Currents Radio, and glad to be with you. If you want to contact me, it's paul@paulfromm.com, paul@paulfromm.com. I want to talk to you about my friend Brad Luff. Now, where do you start with this story? Well, let me just give you kind of the headline, though. A man jailed. For nothing more than the non-violent expression of his political views. In letters. Yeah. I want you to be clear about this. This happened in Canada. Yes, and it's recent. We're not talking about North Korea, or Communist China, or Castro's Cuba, or Burma, or Myanmar, whatever it's calling itself this week. No, this happened in the Dominion of Canada. Let me go back a little bit and kind of start first things first. Brad Love's a 53-year-old laboring man. He has worked much of his life in the construction trades, a general kind of handyman, bricklayer, and so on. Last 6 years, he's worked up in the oil patch in Fort McMurray. Actually, makes quite a good buck doing a skilled construction job in the oil patch. Okay, now Brad has always had, Brad is a voracious reader of politics and history, and Brad has an abiding interest in politics, and he is more than ready to share his opinion. It's quite frankly, is in my opinion, not just his right, but I think it's the obligation of citizens to participate. Don't you think so? To participate. You know, in U.S. federal elections, fewer than 50% of the population can even haul its butt out to vote. You know, participatory democracy, and I know the United States is a republic, not a democracy, but participatory government will not work without participation. It will then be prone to minority control and interest. Now, you know, whether it's an ethnic minority or whether it's a financial minority, you need public support and not public participation. And I don't mean just at election time. Real functioning self-government involves people being interested, speaking up, discussing, and debating, and then presumably voting intelligently. Anyway, Brad Walker. So Brad has had this abiding interest in news and politics. He's a news junkie. And for over 20 years, Brad would sit down on his morning coffee break, take up his local his newspaper and read. And he might see something that struck his attention, and he would fire off a letter, sometimes the letter to the editor, sometimes a letter to a politician, and so on. Occasionally, these were more commentary submissions than an actual letter. One thing he liked to do is he'd photocopy an article from the newspaper, or even just take the newspaper itself, cut the article out, and make some comments in magic marker on the article and fire it off to a public official. Brad believes that over a period of 20 years, he wrote more than 10,000 letters. Now, there is a very interested, opinionated guy. And you sit and you ask, well, okay, well, what interests Brad? Well, doesn't like third world immigration. He thinks it's a disaster for Canada. He also believes, and I think the statistics are there to back him up, that not all, but many of the poorly screened third world immigrants that have been pouring into Canada over the last 30 years are involved in crime. Crime's they are seriously involved in crime. This immigration revolution or coup d'etat that occurred in Canada in 1965, same year it occurred in the United States, where both our countries turned our backs on our traditional sources of immigration, namely the British Isles and Europe, and instead kicked open the doors to the third world. That's not been very good for Canada. And that's a big issue with him. Third world immigration, not a good thing, he says. Poorly screened third world immigration, highly involved in crime. He doesn't like that. He thinks Canadian foreign aid is wasted. Certainly, I agree with him. I wrote a book about that some years ago. And thirdly, he's not very keen on the state of Israel. Okay. Now, I don't know how you would want to characterize that. I don't like the term right wing, but because it covers a great many views. You might call Brad a bit of a populist, but anyway, okay, those are Brad's views. Now, Brad has a way of needling people. I mean, Brad is an aggressive, in-your-face sort of guy. Hey, we need people like that. You know, we used to call people like that mavericks or gadflies. You know, I think every society needs a few people like that. You know, people are prepared to say to the high and mighty, you're a jerk. Or, no, you're not wearing a magnificent cloak there, your emperorship, you're buck naked, and you're not very handsome to boot. We need people like Brad. Anyway, Brad had received several official warnings from the police that if he persisted, he could be charged with harassment. Now, honest, I'll bless him. Ow. How can you harass somebody by writing them letters? Well, some of these wimpy, disgusting politicians were upset. Anyway, it all came to a head in 2003. Brad wrote the then chief of police of York Region, and that's the part of York County that's just north of the city of Toronto. His name was Armand Labarge. He's a big Zionist. He's a big guy who's boasted how he had Brad Love arrested and how he likes to fight hate. He's in with the Jewish Congress, a Jewish lobby that's big on fighting hate. So anyway, Brad Love wrote him a letter, and he said, why don't you level with the people in York Region? Apparently the York Regional Police had just gotten a mobile command center that's going to cost $750,000. And this is some sort of a bus with all sorts of super electronics in it. And this was going to help deal with growing crime in York Region. And Brad said, why don't you tell them that the reason for growing crime is immigration? That we've got these Jamaican drug-pushing gangs, these gangsters from the islands, and we have Vietnamese criminals running rub-and-tug, body-rub joints that are basically fronts for prostitution and also pushing drugs. Okay, the facts in Brad's letter were broadly correct. One day, Brad is on a work site out near Cambridge, Ontario, and he's on the second story of a school. He's got some bricks in his hands, and several, around the noon hours, several policemen, plainclothes policemen, come up on the roof. Brad Love! Yes. Drop your weapon! Well, his weapon was a trowel. He's about to mortar up some bricks. Drop your weapon! The guns come out! Brad eventually drops the trowel. They slam him on the ground, handcuffs, and he's hauled off. Now, you know, this is what's called maximum impact takedown. Brad Love wasn't going anywhere. He went from home to work, home to work to home. Was this necessary? Well, high impact takedown is not so much to arrest the guy. It's to humiliate him and send a warning. You don't want to be too close to that guy. Do you want to be arrested in front of your workmates? Probably not. This is goonery. The sort of stuff you'd expect in a place like Myanmar. Anyway, Brad's hauled off to jail, and he finds out he's charged with 20 counts. He wrote to, one is the letter to Armand LaBarge, and that's really what got it going. But he had also written on other immigration-type topics to 19 politicians, most of them federal members of Parliament. So he finds himself charged with willful promotion of hate under Canada's notorious hate law, Section 319 of the Criminal Code, which says it is a criminal offense to willfully promote hatred against certain privileged groups. That's race, religion, sex, sexual orientation. Now, there are defenses. Truth is one defense. Sincerely held religious beliefs another defense. And so is discussing a matter the discussion of which is in the public interest. Okay, so there are defenses. Here's the kicker. I'm not sure if I read you the entire law, but it's the willful promotion of hatred other than in private private conversation. Wait a sec. Brad didn't hand these letters out up and down Main Street in Toronto. He didn't go to a mall and hand out his views. He wrote to 20 individuals. He actually should never be charged. Problem is that without a good lawyer, and there aren't that many in Canada, and even fewer are prepared to take on politically incorrect dissidents, you are screwed, and Brad certainly was. Brad was tossed into a place that could well have been the Bastille. It's the old Toronto Don Jail. It was old when Queen Victoria died at the turn of the beginning of the 20th century. It's a hellhole. Anyway, Brad was in there for 4 months. And the way Brad will tell it, and he's given this talk from coast to coast in the Dominion of Canada, it's there I was in jail. My apartment was a mess. My landlord was about to, you know, turf my goods out. My bank account, I was without a job. Well, obviously he's in jail. My bank account was dwindling. And unfortunately, and I'd say this to Brad's face, he was forced or coerced into making a deal. And his lawyer badly, badly let him down. Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. You might expect. Now, this is a non-violent, in quotation marks, crime. Brad, as was his right in both Canada and the United States, appeared in court a day or two later to seek bail. And he was told in no uncertain terms, Love, you're not going to get bail. You know, somebody up there really hated him. Now, we've got Jamaican gunsels that have committed murder who actually get bail. Attempted murder, gun charges, drug pushing, no problemo. But Mr. Love, who wrote about black crime, didn't commit any crime, wasn't involved in violence against anybody, couldn't. He was told, you're never going to get bail, Love. Well, what they did was they divided the charges among four different police forces. York Region, that's where Armand LaBarge held court. Ontario Provincial Police, Peel region, that's where Brad lived, and the city of Toronto. Each of these police forces apparently took five counts. So Brad appeared in court on five counts of filed against him by York Regional Police. And he was told, you'll not get bail. Well, eventually, his parents put up the value of their house, which was, at that point, over $250,000. So Brad was granted bail on five of the charges, and the price was the surety of the parents' house, $250,000. An incredible amount of money pledged for a non-violent crime. Well, just as Brad was about to embrace freedom, he was tapped on the shoulder and said, oh, hang on there, love. We've got five charges from the Ontario Provincial Police against you, five counts. And there'll be five counts from Metro Toronto Police and five counts from Peel Region. Your parents don't have enough money to get you out. And in fact, that was the case. Brad did not get out on bail. Now, this is political goonery and thuggery. Normally, all the charges, especially as they're all identical, it's just letters written to different people, they're all bundled together, and one bail applies to them all. Well, not in Brad's case. So Brad sat in the Don jail for about 4 months, and finally, he cried uncle. His lawyer got him a deal. Oh my gosh. Now, normally, with a plea bargain, what happens is, a number of the counts are dropped, and you get a break on the sentence. The theory being you're saving the state, or we call them the crown in Canada, a lot of time and money. And you plead guilty, it looks good on their record, conviction, and you get a deal in that you get a lesser sentence. Well, not for Brad. He was also charged with a weapons charge. He had a hunting knife in his car. Well, even in Canada, that's not a dangerous weapon, but he pleaded guilty to the whole kit and caboodle, and he got 18 months in jail. Now, that was the longest sentence ever handed down under Canada's hate law. He was judicially bamboozled. I'm the first one to admit, it's easy to say Brad should have sat in jail and fought. But with the backlog in the Ontario legal system, he might have been there 6 months more, or longer. I know it's very easy to say, what you should have done is sit there and fight, and you would have won. But he didn't, so fine. He's off to jail on an 18-month sentence. He serves 11 months, and he gets out. Oh, yes, but there's a parole condition. The parole condition is he's not allowed to write to any of the 20 politicians he'd written to before. All right. One perhaps can see that. So Brad gets out in 2004, and I put him on our lecture circuit because I think this is an absolute outrage. The story, a man jailed for nothing more than the non-violent expression in letters of his political views. Now, don't feel too proud. Some of those old-timers, we went to World War II, we fought against Hitler, who was going to... We fought for democracy. I know some old vets who say, if I knew now, knew then what I know now, I'd never have gone. It was a crock. Like, fighting for democracy. We don't have it here. This is Paul Farm. You're on the fighting side of me here on Countercurrents Radio. I will be back in just a couple of minutes to continue the Brad Love story. And just as a little bit of inspiration, I'm going to play the tune, I'm a Good Old Rebel. I think there are a whole lot of us in the freedom movement who kind of see ourselves in those terms. A good old rebel. Well, maybe a good young rebel.
Well, I'm a good old rebel, and that is what I am. And in this land of freedom, I fought all the horsemen. But I fought against him, I only wish we'd won. And I don't want no pardon for anything I've done. 300,000 Yankees are shipped in southern dust. We got 300,000 before they conquered us. They died of southern fever and southern steel and shock. And I wish it was 3 million instead of what we got. Well, I hate the sticky nation and everything they do. Well, I hate the Declaration of Independence too. I hate the glorious Union, it's dripping with our blood. And I hate the striped banner, I fought it on our food. Well, we reconstructed, I'm better now than then. And for their carpet bagger, well, I don't give a darn. Well, I'm full for their frontier as soon as I can go. Well, I'll prepare my weapon and start for Mexico.
Hope you like that. I'm a Southern Rebel. This is Paul Frond. You're on the fighting side of me here on Countercurrents Radio. I was probably telling you the Brad Love story, the man who was thrown in jail for 18 months for the non-violent writing letters involving the non-violent expression of his political views. Okay, so Brad got out of jail in 2004, and there was a parole condition, and that was he was not to write to any of the 20 political figures, Republican figures that he'd written to before. Fair enough. So Brad's a very industrious fellow, immediately went back to work, and some months later, when he appears at his parole officer's for his, I think it was, monthly little visit, a few burly detectives slam him against his car, handcuffs go on, and he's charged with breach of probation. Now, what did he done? Well, he'd written some other politicians. Well, somebody up there hated him. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Brad served about 26 days in jail, and again, you know, the whole thing is to break the man down. He should have gone to court, in my opinion. Fought it and won. But he didn't. He was saying, you know, I want to work. I mean, here I am sitting in jail, bored out of my skull. I'm not earning any money. So he said, okay, well, what do you offer? Well, they said, plead guilty, and we'll give you time served. He did. Problem is, though, every time you plead guilty, that gets you deeper into the octopus arms of the rotten system. Well, this time they increased his, tightened his parole conditions. Now he was not allowed to write to any elected official. You know, we tried to get him publicity. I've been doing publicity for Brad for quite a while. Now, in what country, I ask you, was this old Soviet Russia? Was this communist China, North Korea, or bloody Myanmar? He's not allowed to write to any elected official? Come on! Anyway, those are his conditions. Brad then got the idea that, he could write to the newspaper. So there's a paper in the West End of Toronto called the Etobicoke Guardian. It's a community weekly that comes out a couple times a week. It's largely a vehicle for advertising. But so Brad started sending the Etobicoke Guardian some letters. And they were about black crime, and that's really quite relevant because, actually, not a mile from where the offices of the Etobicoke Guardian are, up in the northwest part of Etobicoke, is an area with a tremendous, a large number of public housing or Ontario housing units and a great deal of black crime. In fact, it's not unusual on a summer night to hear pop, 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 pop. Yeah, the brothers are either settling a dispute or just firing off a few rounds or whatever. High crime area. So Brad Love was sending in some letters about black crime and also some clippings of newspaper articles with his commentary attached. Believe it or not, they called the cops. And once again, Brad Law was hauled off to prison. Eastman spent 6 months in prison. You know, I was so outraged at this. I went to the Etobicoke Guardian and I confronted the editor. I said, you know, how could you? Well, he wrote so many letters. I said, well, so what? Well, the staff was uneasy. Well, again, so what? What do you mean uneasy? Well, he seemed to be so opinionated, and he wrote so many letters. Well, I said, how old are you? I mean, are we the total land of a wimp, the land of the utterly castrated male? We're all so delicate. I mean, he wrote these letters. I mean, I said, well, he didn't like them. If you weren't going to publish them, you throw them in the garbage can. Well, we were upset. Well, we didn't know what he would do. I said, well, what do you think he would do? People know Brad Love in the media around Toronto. They've known him for years. I mean, Brad's never gone around and assaulted anybody or blown up, tried to blow up the radio station. I mean, the newspaper station office, the newspaper office. Come on. They called the police. And I said, you know, you people are a disgrace. You really ought to consider going to Cuba and writing for a totalitarian country's publication like Grandma. Yeah, that's what I told them. And I thought, you know, your reporters cover traffic accidents, fires, where, you know, I'm sure they see bodies and glass and blood all over the road. And they're intimidated or upset at Brad Love's letters on immigration. And I have to emphasize, these are non-threatening. And when I've told this story numerous times in the United States, people sometimes say, oh, come on, Paul, there must be more to it than that. I mean, he was threatening people, wasn't he? No, he's not threatening. Anyway, Brad served 6 months in jail, got out. Now the bail condition was he wasn't allowed to write to anybody. I know, you have to pinch yourself really hard to realize we're not talking about communist Cuba, Red China, Myanmar, the Congo, or some other hellhole. We're talking about Canada. Here is a man not allowed to write to anybody. Now, I, as his publicist, did, and with our Canadian Association for Free Expression, tried to get that story out. Now, we got it out to a fair number of audiences, but, you know, the mass media just treats you to one big ignorant cacyon. They're not interested. Unbelievable. Anyway, now Brad cannot write to anybody. I'm sorry, cannot write to anybody without their permission. 3 years ago, I had Brad speaking in one of the monthly meetings of the Canadian Association for Free Expression, and he was speaking about freedom of speech. Near the end of the meeting, in fact, just after question period, when people were milling around, looking at a book table and chatting, in came 8 burly Toronto police detectives. I could actually hear the clinking, and the clinking were the handcuffs. Brad's, the handcuffs are snapped on to Brad. He calls for one of our people, could you get me my jacket? So they do, and they come outside the door. And, isn't it interesting,
The papers that were not at all interested in the ongoing persecution of Brad Love, the Canada's, you know, the equivalent of the New York Times, the Globe and Mail has a reporter there snapping the picture. And the next day, the story appears in the paper, man arrested for hate at meeting. Now, the implication might be that he was arrested for something he said at the meeting. It wasn't. What he had done was he had written letters to the Canadian Jewish Congress, the League for Human Rights of B'nai B'rith, I believe the Friends of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and the York University Students Union, Jewish Students Union, and he was being arrested for that. The tremendous fight to get Brad out on bail. Once again, remember, these are this is breach of probation. Usually, even if the breach of probation, as he said, it means going around and punching your old lady in the face, and you've been told not to. I mean, you've been told, you know, to observe a no contact rule. Usually, that's going to get you maybe 90 days in prison. Oh, not for Brad. To get out on bail this time, his relatives had to put up the value of their house, which is about over $100,000. And Brad had to put up $22,000 cash. Once again, he's not to write to anybody without their consent, and he goes back to his job in Alberta. He has been back to Ontario 10 times for his trial on breach of probation. This is not abuse of process, it's an abuse by process. You know, the trial will hold a day or two worth of hearings, and then it will adjourn for a number of months, a day or two more. You wonder how anybody could even keep the issue straight. Well, they can't. And that's the bottom line. It's a farce. And every appearance, Brad has to not only pay his lawyer, but he has to fly out from Fort McMurray up in the northern part of Alberta to Toronto, rent a car, pay for meals, accommodations. Every one of these appearances costs him at least $1,000 in travel, plus, of course, the legal fees. Finally, in May, he was convicted. On the 13th of July, unlucky, Friday the 13th, Brad Love was sentenced to 18 months in prison for breach of probation. That's right. That's right, in Canada, not in the Congo or Red China or Communist Cuba or whatever. 18 months for writing letters. Now, he defended himself. He said, listen, the conditions were I was supposed to get their permission. I phoned them up, he said. I phoned these organizations and said, I've seen some of, you know, statements you made in the papers on, you know, on, it had to do with Israeli Apartheid Week, or opposed to Israeli Apartheid Week. And Brad was kind of twitting them. He agrees with, you know, Israeli Apartheid, or, you know, down with Israeli Apartheid. So he said, I've seen some of your statements. I've written some things on these matters. May I send them to you? They all gave him permission. The judge said, well, they didn't give him informed permission. They didn't know what they were getting. Well, I don't know. If somebody says, can I send you an information package about our company's product? And I say yes. Well, I don't know exactly what I'm going to get in the mail, but I've given my permission. Anyway, that wasn't enough for the judge, who didn't let the defense win a single motion. So, Brad was convicted, 18 months more in jail, and 3 more years of so-called probation. Those conditions, well, he's not to write his political views to any political organization, or religious organization, cultural organization, media, without being invited to do so. Only if a group gives him permission, and furthermore, his parole officer agrees to him, may Brad write a letter about his political views. So, of course, Brad could write to us. I guess that's if the parole officer agrees, because I would certainly give him permission. How's he going to write a letter to the editor? Unless he gets the permission in advance. This is absolute
psycho police state stuff. All because Brad is politically incorrect. Brad was sentenced on July 13th. Brad got out just this past week. He got out on August the 29th. And, you know, it had taken the better part of 6 weeks and a change of lawyers to get him out on bail, pending an appeal. Because he is going to fight this one. He's going to appeal to the Ontario Court of Appeals, but he's going to appeal both the conviction and the the sentence. Once again, bail in surety of $200,000 plus the $22,000 cash that Brad has already put up. It is an absolutely, in my opinion, shocking story. An indictment of Canada's psychotic hate laws and Canada's sclerotic justice system. You know, Brad was released at 10 o'clock on Wednesday night. And they said, I think it was 8 o'clock. And Brad had over $2,000 in the canteen money. Now, Lindsay's about 70 miles north and east of Toronto, and so to get back to his relatives, Brad would have to get transportation. So he asked for his money. Oh, no, it's all locked up. It's after hours. You know, these bureaucracies are so heartless and inhuman. Anyway, they did give Brad $100, and Brad got a cab. It cost him over $300. And the next day, he had to drive back up there and be made to sit around like a dummy for while they look at his papers and process the papers and wonder, you know, as Brad would put it, you know, what did they think I was up there to do? To steal from my own account? But anyway, he finally got his money and his worldly goods, and we'll head back to Alberta early next week. The date for the appeal is April 29th in Toronto, and I'll certainly be keeping you informed. We're trying to do publicity for Brad. You know, this case should get heard far and wide. And I think it should be a reproach to the Canadian justice system. You know, every time I hear about some poor Chinese dissident, like this architect Wei Wei. Now, Wei Wei got in trouble with the Chinese government for things he wrote, and he was tossed in jail for, I think, about 90 days. Jeez, glad his name isn't Brad Love. He'd have been in there for 18 months. But when he came out of jail a little over a year and a half ago, he was denied his political rights for a year, which meant that he couldn't give interviews to the foreign press. And many of our papers, including our Globe and Mail, denounced that, said that was a terrible thing, and so on. Well, I totally agree with them. It was a terrible thing, horrible black mark on the justice system of communist China, but Brad Love will be made a non-person, forbidden to communicate his political views for 18 months while he's in jail, and for 3 years when he's on probation when he gets out of jail. I hope the Chinese diplomats bring that up to the Canadian diplomats next time our people start wagging their little fingers and protesting about human rights. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on Countercurrents Radio. If you'd like to contribute to our efforts to help Brad Love, send your check. Doesn't matter whether it's U.S. or U.S. dollars, Canadian money, check or money order to CAFE. That stands for the Canadian Association for Free Expression. To CAFE, Box 332, Rexdale. That's Rexdale, Ontario. That's capital O, capital N, and our zip code is M9W5L3, Canada. One more time, if you want to help Brad Love battle for his rights, help us get publicity for him, send your contribution to CAFE, Box 332, Rexdale, Ontario, and that's Rexdale, Ontario, capital O, capital N. Postal code is M, like Mother, 9, W, like William, 5, L, like Larry, 3, Canada. The battle goes on, and we're going to be challenging Amnesty International if Brad goes back to jail. They recognize a prisoner of conscience as a person who was persecuted for the nonviolent expression of their political, ethnic, religious, racial views, that certainly is Brad Love. I think we've got to get more attention to this, you know, because the justice system is a bull. And easy to beat up on somebody who has no friends, nobody prepared to stand for them. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side with me. Back with you again really soon here on Counter Currents Radio.
Love's pride, the summer glow, a shine.